Well, as I begin my sermon today, I wonder how many of you have given any thought over the past week to the letter that I talked about last week. Have you perhaps thought about the letter of encouragement that you might write, perhaps? Or have you even taken a stab at writing one? Last week, as we look at the letter to the exiles, in Jeremiah chapter 29, we were noticing in particular, I think, the power of a word of encouragement. And I had us think a little bit about that word, encourage, to somehow hand over to someone else a strength that is in your heart. To somehow take a thing that is necessary for a person to stand well on their own two feet, to face a storm in life, something that's in here, deep inside, and somehow to hand it over to somebody else. Encourage. I like that word. To take our courage, perhaps, and to put it in somebody else's heart. Jeremiah was encouraging those exiles of Judah who had been taken away from their homes by King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army in the year 597 and taken a long way off back to Babylon to live there in that land between the Tigris and the Euphrates. His words that we read are strength and grace for a people to continue to go on living, even thriving in a new place, in a new land. Through this series and preaching through Jeremiah, I've been preaching through mostly the same passages that come up in the lectionary calendar of readings, which is also in Jeremiah right now, except that I've taken them in a somewhat different order. I've had us walk through this book mostly in the historical order of things as they arose in Jeremiah's life. I've had us look at a lot of the early parts of his ministry first, and then at the middle parts second, and we will come to the third parts later. Because there is a sort of progression in Jeremiah's ministry that I want you to notice through this series, and I've tried to fill in the history here and there to try and give you a better sense of how his ministry is progressing and where it's heading in light of all that's happening around him. It's helpful, I think, to think about Jeremiah's life in ministry in something like three different phases. In the early phase, we'll call it phase one. Jeremiah is dealing with a people and with kings and with priests and with prophets that are wayward and complacent. They've gone way off track. They've allowed sin and their own sense of complacent self-satisfaction to take over their lives and to rule the day. They're way, way too comfortable in way too dangerous a time. They can't see the train wreck that's coming. And in phase one of Jeremiah's ministry, it's his job to warn them of what is coming and to do his very best to try and convince them through whatever means necessary to change their course. And as we've seen already last week, phase one failed. Phase one failed. Jeremiah faithfully carried out his job, but the people was unresponsive and were carried off into exile in two successive waves. What I want to call phase two of the prophet's ministry really takes place in and around those two waves. The first, as I mentioned last week, being the carrying off of all of those skilled, all of those educated people of the land out along with the nation's treasures to Babylon. And the second is what happened 10 years later in the year 587 BC when Nebuchadnezzar came back to Jerusalem and took the rest of the inhabitants and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, razing it to the ground. Between those two events, more or less, is Jeremiah's second phase. Indeed, where we pick up in our reading today, it's in the middle of that second siege. Jeremiah is literally trapped inside of the city of Jerusalem while Babylonians are besieging it on the outside. In just a moment or two, you'll see the picture this morning of Babylonians sieging the city, of the city on fire and of the territory all around it on the outside laid waste. And my question here today is, what is the prophet doing here today? What is this second phase of ministry anyway? What was he doing last week in the wake of that prior disaster? I take the trouble to point this out to you because I want you to notice something about Jeremiah's ministry in the larger sweep of its unfolding. You know, when the nation is wayward, way back here, and complacent, he was at work trying to get them to see what's way up here, to try to get them to wake up. But when it is way up here, when it's wounded and hurting, even though there's certainly still some of that pleading going on, Jeremiah is already moved on. And he's equipping them and teaching them how to hope when hope is very much the farthest possibility from their mind. That's Jeremiah in the second phase of his ministry, I think. The disaster has hit. The consequences of this people's way of life has yielded its fruits, and Jeremiah has begun to move on from tearing down to building back up again. Jeremiah is always one step ahead of where his people are, you see. When they're back here, desensitized and oblivious, he's up here ahead of time, talking about what's about to unfold. When they're at disaster, he's already moved on to encouraging and rebuilding. In today's reading, Jeremiah has bought a field, purchased an investment property in the middle of a siege. Right in the middle of one of the worst catastrophes to ever occur in the history of ancient Israel. Ever. He is being held captive by a king for daring to say exactly the thing that was in fact happening in the city at that very moment. Things are not looking good right now for Jeremiah and for this people. Jeremiah's cousin is looking to offload some property. And Jeremiah happily makes the purchase, signs the deed, stores it away, all while he's holed up in there in the middle of a city that's being besieged. He's making a statement there, not with his words, but with his actions, a statement that God has laid down on his heart to make so that everybody knows and sees what he's doing. He's buying the field in Anathoth because one day this will all be over and this people again will be able to plant in their fields again. They'll be able to plant in fields in peace on their own home soil because God has made a promise to this people that even though they're enduring a tremendous ordeal in the meantime, there is still a future in this land. Thinking back a little bit to the children's sermon this morning, has it ever occurred to you that a seed is like a little promise in some significant ways? Jesus, for example, often spoke of the symbolism that's hidden within a seed. So often, seeds are things that get us thinking about a plentiful harvest that's eventually going to come forth from the ground, right? And there's this really interesting contrast of experiences when you plant seeds, isn't there? Because the moment you plant them, you can't see them anymore. They're buried away in the ground below the surface, and all there is to do is to wait for them to spring up, to hope for them to spring up. And the thing is that having planted the seed, you know something is out there. In those fields, maybe, in that pot. You look at those fields, you look at that pot differently because you know that something with enormous life potential is just below the surface and can come to bloom at any moment. But in the meantime, you're left to wait in hope. You know, it's a different thing to look on a garden or a pot in which you've planted a seed, in which you know what's underneath the soil there, than it is to look on a garden that you haven't planted, right? When you look on a field or a garden or a pot that you haven't seeded, you don't look at it with the same kind of expectation, the same kind of knowledge, perhaps. You don't know that there's something underneath there bubbling up to the surface. And on the surface, they might look exactly the same. But the one that you've seeded is the one that you know has a burst of life soon on the horizon. Isn't that interesting to think about? One field or garden can look exactly the same, whether it's seeded or not, but you look at it with a different sort of knowledge and expectation when you know that there's something just under the soil there that's making its way to the surface and that's loaded with life. When Jeremiah and the average Israelite of his time and place looked out on their own countrysides, out onto their own fields, chances are the very same images met their eyes, right? But the barren and the burned countryside for Jeremiah is seeded, you see. Whereas for most everyone else living in this moment of tragedy and hardship, it's just empty, wasted, devastated soil. When Jeremiah purchases this field, he's communicating to his people that this, though, is seeded soil. There's hope. And there's new life just below the surface, just waiting to burst through. Jeremiah's ministry of hope is to tell and to encourage his people that their soil is seeded soil. How about you? When I and you and everyone else look out at the world, the same pictures come back to our naked eyes, don't they? We all see the same things. But some of us see seeded soil, while others just see vacant soil. And the difference between those two is not a difference in eyesight. It's a difference in understanding, isn't it? You see, because while they see the same things with their two eyes, one of them knows just what's below the soil and what's about to burst forth so that they can look out for that coming burst of life. Church, Jesus' people are seed below the surface people. Jesus' people know and expect the garden to burst to life because we know that God has seeded the soil. That's hope. That's what hope is, looking at that very same soil and knowing that something is coming. Living in the knowledge that garden is about to bloom. And we are called to live with such hope, operate day to day with such hope that the seeds are in the soil already. Proclaim such hope, people of God. Spread the word. The soil is seeded. Help other people to see the truth of that. To know that all of that vacant soil around is already seeded ground. That's who we are. That is who we are called to be for the world. Amen.